On this episode of This Week in Linux, we follow up on the kernel performance issues we discussed last week. There's going to be a new contender in the Linux mobile market using Plasma Mobile. We'll also check out some distro news from Fedora, Black Arch, and Intel's Clear Linux. A lot of exciting app news was released this week for upcoming releases to Blender, Kodi, and many more. Later in the show, we'll check out a new game from Valve and some security news. All that and much more coming up. I'm Michael Tunnell with Tux Digital, and this is your weekly source for Linux GNUs. Before we get started, since Christmas is right around the corner, I've created a limited time coupon for the Linux is Everywhere t-shirt. 20% off discount when you use the code LINUXMAS. LINUXMAS. The Linux is Everywhere t-shirt is the shirt I made to celebrate the proliferation of Linux. The concept of the design has Tux blended into the background to convey the message. Even if you aren't aware that Linux is there, it probably is. The shirt is available for shipping in North America and in Europe. So if you want to go, you can go to tuxdigital.com/Linux is Everywhere, or if you're in Europe, /Linux is Everywhere EU for shipping inside of Europe. And remember the coupon code LINUXMAS, LINUXMAS. Up first in the show this week is the kernel STIBP patch that we talked about last week. Those backports have actually been reverted. So the 4.19.4 and the 4.14.83 kernels have reverted the performance-killing STIBP, or the single-thread indirect branch predictors that we previously reported that had been effect to 50% degradation on performance, thanks to the Spectre issues, because, yeah, Spectre and Meltdown, still going. I'm probably going for a little bit longer, too. Anyway, so it appears that Linus's complaint about it was heard, and they decided to, collectively switch it back and switch it up a little bit to see what they could do to make it not so bad. So with the latest versions of 4.19 and 4.14, they're not putting it on by default at all. I think they've actually removed them completely, or at least reverted those particular patches. However, the 4.20 kernel will have some of these, will have some of the mitigation applied, but only if you choose to apply it. So by default, it will be off. And then if you turn it on, it will only apply to certain processes and certain types of processes. So it won't be like it was globally turned on, which crushed the performance. And once they decided to do that, they decided to remove it from only certain processes that are really important that potentially could be affected. But at the same time, most people will not be affected by this particular issue. So they decided to turn it off by default. So if you're like an enterprise company or something like that with a big infrastructure, you might want to turn it on. But for the most part, most people don't have to worry about it. So yeah, if you'd like to learn more about this particular topic, you can find a link in the show notes to the Pharonix article, as well as the posts from Greg KH and Linus about these particular topics. Up next in the show is the Nikuno Mobile, which is an open phone or open source phone that is going to be using Plasma Mobile, which is awesome. I'm a big fan of Plasma, so I look forward to trying out Plasma Mobile. However, the last time I've heard people talking about Plasma Mobile, there has been some issues, so it's kind of interesting that they chose to do this for the default. But hopefully that it is, by the time they release the phone, it will be ready to go. I think that Plasma Mobile is a fantastic looking interface, and when they've shown the demos and stuff, it looked great. So I hope that this gets to the point where it could be a great solution. Right now, the Nikuno device is not actually available yet. They said it's going to be using a 5.5-inch touchscreen, aluminum body with the Linux kernel 4.14, which is an LTS, and the ARM Cortex A9 quad-core processor, and the Vivanti GPU. Now, this particular phone is using the IMX6 Cortex i9, and this is actually kind of similar to the Librem 5 in many ways, but also a little bit different. The KDE team said it's important that developers within the mobile ecosystem are available to work with open devices, which are easy to modify and tweak, and not locked to vendors to a particular operating system. Completely agree with that because, you know, typically right now they're all locked. Because, you know, if even Android, you're essentially locked because the phones have these, like, specific baseband structures that kind of make it locked in a way. But anyway, there's no price or release date yet for this particular device, but the guess is around, like, it's going to be cheaper than Librem 5, probably because the processor itself is a little older than the one that's going to be in the Librem 5. The Librem 5 said they're going to be using the IMX8, whereas this one will be the IMX6. So the likelihood that it'll probably cost around like $200 cheaper or so. So I'm guessing $350, $450, something like that. But anyway, it's an interesting device. And if they do get that price point, I think that'll be a very solid price point for an open source phone. That'd be pretty cool. But they haven't really given a release date. And I think that it'll probably be like maybe mid. If this is not a prototype, it kind of looks like a prototype, but if it's not, mid-2019, because the Librem 5 says they're going to be releasing in April 2019, but because of the delays with the IMX8, there's probably going to push it back even farther to like the second half or maybe even the fourth quarter of 2019. So I think that it's possible that the new Kino, because they're using something that's already available and they don't have to worry about the delays with the processor, they'll probably beat them to the market as far as like when it happens. But if you're interested, the link for this article from the KDE, as well as the link to the Nikino's website, will be in the show notes below. Up next in the show, Fedora has announced that it's not really an announcement. It's more of a discussion on their mailing list that there could be a potential retooling delay for Fedora 31. So Fedora 30 will be coming out fairly soon, in a couple months or so, and Fedora 31 could be delayed up to about a year, so that they can do retooling for their infrastructure. And the reason they're doing it is because they've had some issues with how long it takes for certain things to happen. So like certain builds, before they, when they build it and compile it, then they can test it. The process to get to that, to do all that, that everything could be about 12 hours or so. So they could only do it like roughly once a day, depending on what time of the day they do the actual changes. So it, like, having this retooling structure would allow them to increase that up to like 4 hours instead of 12, it could be like four, or maybe even faster if they were to, you know, optimize it even further. But they said that four would probably be like the most likely scenario. So if they were to do that, that would allow them to output more releases and updates to the system much quicker. And also, there's a kind of a joke about how Fedora typically says they release every 6 months, but then they really don't. They usually release every like 7 to 9 months, maybe like 8 in an average. And there's often where you'll see Fedora has been, you know, set back or postponed for this release for a week or 2 weeks or something like that, or even a month sometimes. That happens, and it's pretty much because of this tooling structure that creates this delay sequence between when they build it and when they test it. So by restructuring it, they'd be able to mitigate that problem and actually get the release on a certain, like a reasonable, accurate time frame, so they could say when it's going to be released and we'll actually get to that point. So that would be really good for them. And they've been talking about this for quite a while before the IBM purchase of Red Hat. So if you're wondering, no, that's not related. But this is something that's interesting, and it could affect Fedora in a positive way in the long term, but in the short term might make it feel like they're just, you know, not working on it. But, you know, a lot of people look at releases not coming out as an issue of them not working on it. But I think this probably is a good idea for them to do it, and it also allows them to make it where the Fedora community can support, run the testing and actually like the building stuff themselves, so that they would be able to not have to rely on the Fedora team so much to create those Fedora labs, basically. But from this is another interesting set of proposals that are happening. One of them is an annual release proposal. They're suggesting that instead of doing the 6 months, that they are to consider doing a once a year release. And there has been quite a bit of pushback from that, though, saying that there are some people had concerns about outdated software, and not just for 6 months, but, you know, you'd have outdated software up to a year. You know, Fedora updates things like the kernel and underlying components, but they don't typically update user facing stacks like the GNOME shell and stuff like that, or like GTK toolkit and stuff. So there could be issues there. And then based on that, another discussion happened where they were talking about potentially making Fedora a rolling release through Fedora Rawhide. Now, Fedora Rawhide is, you know, it has its own set of problems, but they said that it's possible with this new retooling efforts that it might make it possible for the rolling Rawhide structure to actually create a rolling release practical approach. So that would be quite interesting, and I think that either way, this retooling thing is probably a good idea. If they could actually set up a rolling release version of it, that would be very, very cool. So I look forward to seeing what happens, because it seems like 2019 is going to be very interesting for Fedora, so that's going to be pretty cool. If you'd like to learn more about this, you can find a link in the show notes. Up next in the show is Blender 2.80 beta has been released for testing, if you'd like to. And if you haven't heard, Blender is a fantastic, ridiculously powerful application for video editing, game development, 3D modeling, compositing, all kinds of stuff. Like, there's a ton of different things. Like, there's also like painting effects, texturing, and all kinds of stuff like that. Blender is very robust and very cool. For the longest time, it's had one of the most irritatingly painful interfaces ever made. But one of the best thing about this new release is that they've massively improved the interface itself. They've also redesigned it so it's nicer looking, has like a dark theme with flat icons. They've also changed it so like the menus are more consistent. The titles of different effects and shortcuts and structs and stuff like that are all more consistent as much as possible anyway. Depending on the type of, like, whatever mode you're using, it doesn't matter. They're trying to make it as much as possible to be consistent. I mean, they're also doing a switch where selecting items and box selection have now been switched to the left-click mouse button. And now I know you're wondering, what? Why was it ever not the left-click? I don't know. But for years, actually very many years, it has always been right-click to select and do box selection. But hey, this is much better. And actually, this is also improves it so that you could use like a tablet or like a Wacom tablet or something like that. And then you could use like the pen type and or like a touchscreen tablet, because it makes it more, because every time you touch it, it's a left click in like signal. So it allows that to function. So maybe they might make a Blender for mobile. I'm not sure why, but they would. Who knows? But also, they've done a lot of cool things. They've upgraded the tool system. They are, as far as like how it's laid out. They've created this new like workspace thing where you can arrange, like you can create workspaces, or there's actually workspaces based on every tool and every mode. But you can also create your own custom workspaces, so you can customize how the Blender UI functions for you. So however you really want to do it, it's really cool. They've also built this new viewport system called Eevee, or EEVEE, and it focuses on real-time rendering. So it allows you to see a preview of all the renders you're trying to do and all the custom structures and textures and things while you're building it. So that's super powerful, because it used to be where the render times could take, you know, quite a bit of time depending on how extensive your model is, and then you wouldn't be able to see the final outcome until the render's done. Now it's doing it real time as you're doing the editing or doing the building of it. So that is super powerful. They've also added a new 2D animation thing called Workbench, which is a type of engine that allows you to manipulate the textures without, like, just the visual of the rendering, the preview, without having to actually change the texture. So you can say, you can activate this like color mode, and it will automatically give a different color contrast, so you can easily pinpoint like different pieces of your model and things like that. Like, really cool, super powerful stuff. And they've also done it where there used to be this issue where there was only a certain amount of layers you could have, which was kind of 20, which is really not a lot for an extensive modeling program. But now you can do an unlimited amount of layers, as well as like collections, which are groups of layers, and you can have multiple subgroups of subgroups and sub collections and stuff like that. And they said it's also an unlimited amount of that too. So lots of cool stuff from Blender, and they're even making it like 30% faster than previous renders. Tons of different things. Like Blender is like, this has been in work for like 3 years, and you can tell because there's so much stuff done and so many things have been improved. The only thing that's kind of interesting in the sense of like, this is such a big change, it will probably make a lot of tutorials kind of like moot and you'd have to redo them. But other than that, this is fantastic. I'm curious about like how the community would be in, like, receptive to all these changes, because there are a lot of cool things and it's hard to actually like describe them without demonstrating them. So if you would like to, I'll in the show notes, I'll have a link to the blog post for the Blender release, as well as a video from Blender describing like their top five different tools that are coming in this particular version. They actually did more than five, but you know, that's just the title, top five. So like, I think there's like eight or nine are in there, whatever. But there's a ton of cool things, and they demonstrate almost all of it, showing you like what all these things are. So if you would like to check that out, I have a link to that in the show notes. Cody 18 Leia has been released a release candidate, technically, the release candidate 1. They haven't really said when they're going to release the full final version, but they are in the final phase of releasing Cody 18, which is very cool. Because there's been about 2 years of work based on this this particular version. And if you're not aware, Kodi is an entertainment center. It allows you to watch video and movies and music and listen to music and all kinds of stuff, like even like picture slideshows and all kinds of things. It's a really nice solution for like home entertainment center and stuff like that. You can actually do a ton of things because Kodi works on so many different devices. You could use pretty much whatever device you have. It'll probably work. Like even if you have a Raspberry Pi, it'll work. Like I actually have a Raspberry Pi Model B from like the second generation, I think. And Kodi runs just fine on it. Like ridiculously, surprisingly well. So if you wanted to use like a newer version Pi, it'll run even better. So like even as small as a even as low powered as a Pi can run Kodi just fine, and you could have it running on your computer, your laptop, or whatever, or a Pi or any kind of set top box. Like even the Amazon Fire TV Stick and stuff like that can run Kodi. So it's a really versatile application, as well as not only just like the features, but also what it can be used on. But this latest release is coming with some really really interesting things. They're actually adding the ability to play DRM content. Now, they haven't really said exactly what that means as far as like what services are related to the DRM. But theoretically, it means that they could be using offering services for Netflix as an add-on and things like that, which would be very cool. Because one of the only drawback, like you can technically use Netflix and Kodi right now. But really the only drawback for Kodi is, for a lot of people, is because it's kind of difficult to set that up to do Netflix on Kodi. So by adding the DRM playback, they could actually facilitate it that you could use Netflix and eliminate any need for any other type of interface, which is fantastic. They've also made it where you can support Android TV leanback suggestions if you wanted to, as well as voice searching and stuff like that. So, and they also said that they're using integrated Wayland support. Not really sure what that means as far as like what relevance that is to a media player, other than just supporting Wayland. Like, how is the integration work? I'm not. Anyway, they haven't really given more details on that, so I'm curious what that would be. So if you know, please let me know in the comments. But this is a lot of cool stuff is coming in Kodi, and I'm a big fan. I've actually contributed to some add-ons over the years, and I've actually built my own add-on and all kinds of things. So Kodi is, you know, one of the projects that I've been a big fan of for like a decade or something like that. I don't know. I first heard of it when it was called XBMC, when it was first released on the Xbox, the first Xbox, the original one, not the Xbox One, because you know they ruined that naming scheme. But anyway, what's another cool thing about it is that Xbox was where it started, and they are now releasing a version on the Xbox for the Xbox One. So you can now get Kodi on the Xbox. So it's kind of like they're returning to their original thing like 15 years ago or something like that. So that's pretty cool too. And if you haven't tried Kodi, I think it's definitely worth it. There are some things you should learn, like you should know about like what it uses and like how to use it and stuff like that. So if you wanted to just install Kodi and run it on your laptop, your desktop, perfectly fine. Feel free to do that. It works great. If you would like to have it on a Raspberry Pi, what you should do is actually check out Libre Elec. It is a distribution that is designed to run Kodi on a variety of different hardware. So you can download. What's really cool is actually Libre Elec has this installer software. So you put this installer software on, let's say, an SD card for the Raspberry Pi or something like that. You can actually, well, in some cases, it's probably better to do this way. You just put it on your desktop. And then you can take the installer. Then you can insert a drive that you want to put the data on, like an SD card. And then you could say, I want to use this particular version of Libre Elec for this piece of this device, and then put it on this drive. And then it will download that data, that file for that image, and then put it on the thing for you. And it makes it really easy to get started with Libre Elec. It's very cool. Now, if you're curious, you might have heard of OpenElec and some other things. Libre Elec is the one I suggest because it is the most reliable and the most stable and the most up to date. Typically, what happens with Libre Elec is Kodi will release a version, and Libre Elec will release a image within like a couple days or hours in some cases. Within the first, I think, 2 days, the last on version 17, they did it within like 2 days. Whereas OpenElec sometimes takes multiple months. So if you already have OpenElec, you could probably just deal with it, I guess, if you want to. But I do think that LibreElec is much better. So if you are interested in trying out Kodi on a Raspberry Pi, then check out LibreElec and check out the show notes for a link to the latest blog post for this potential RC release, as well as a link to LibreElec in the show notes. Up next in the show is the release for Midori 7.0. This is a browser that's known as being a lightweight browser. It uses GTK as the toolkit, and it's got quite a few interesting approaches to how they lay out the system. But first up, this release has fixed issues with the URL auto-completion, YouTube playback, and this invisible text cursor issue they were having. They've also added some benefits to downloads, so you can now get notification bubbles when you start a download, and also when your download's complete, it will highlight the download box on the toolbar until you click it and, you know, dismiss it. And they've added proxy server support, so you can connect to a VPN or Tor or something else to use, like, to browse the internet through Midori rather than the basic ISP connection. And they've also done a lot of other under-the-hood fixes or like related to keyboard input and some other things like opening external links and et cetera for the web apps, I mean. But speaking of that, one of the things that makes Midori kind of stand out is its support for web apps. And now a lot of people might be thinking every browser supports web apps. And that's true. Technically, that's true. But Midori actually has an extra feature built into it that makes the web apps even better. So Midori has a web app manager, a web app manager thing. And the thing about it is that it creates this individual session structure. So first of all, here's a good point about like Chrome. When you create a web app, you can Chrome is always for a long time, it says add to desktop, and it creates this like window for Chrome. But the problem with that is that each of those windows are individual windows added to your system, but they share the same session and cookies and passwords and everything with the main instance of your browser. So if you log into a web app and you make another web app, another copy of that web app, it's still going to be logged into the same session because it shares everything. Whereas Midori takes an individual session approach. So the sessions, the cookies, and things like that are all separated for each web app. So you can actually launch individual web apps as like the multiple web apps as individual accounts and things like that. So it's really nice to have that kind of approach. There are some other browsers that do that, but Epiphany is one of them. And I think you can actually do like your own Electron-based setup if you wanted to. I might make a video about how to do that if people are interested for the Electron thing. But anyway, Midori, as far as like the browsers that have it built in, Midori is one of the best ones that do it. I'm also doing another video about Firefox's container tab structure, which is similar but not the same. So I might do a video about all these. I don't know. Either way, Midori's web app system is actually pretty cool. You might want to check it out. And if you would like to find a check out Midori 7, you can find a link to the website and the blog post for their latest release in the show notes below. Up next in the show is an interesting application, mainly because of what it's called, and that is Yak Yak. Yeah, its name is Yak Yak. Y-A-K-Y-A-K. It's a desktop client for Google Hangouts, and this is more of the chat version of Google Hangouts rather than the video conferencing stuff of it. But what's really cool about it is that it offers a lot of easier usage of Google Hangouts, because Google Hangouts is kind of cumbersome depending on, like, if you have multiple accounts and things like that. Whereas this allows you to have, like, you can send and receive messages from, like, chat, but you can also send and receive messages from Google Voice. So that's really cool. So, and if you have Project Fi with Google Phone, you can use that too. But it's pretty cool because you can send messages back and forth with Google Voice that way. And that way you have a desktop client for that. It also allows you to have conversations with multiple people. You get notifications built into your operating system, whatever your desktop is. All kinds of different things like drag and drop images for uploading. So you can just, or you can just do like the attach button. That works too. There's a lot of stuff too. You can show inline images, like kind of like a sticker approach sort of thing. It also shows you when people are typing, you're talking to someone, it says this person is typing, blah, blah. Those kind of chat messages, like, it's kind of built into Google Hangouts, but they've integrated it well into this client. This client is almost certain, almost guaranteed it's based in Electron. I don't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure it is. For the most part, it's using the web app structure, but it's a lot of modifications to make it like the layout and UI more custom. And while it does technically have integration with the video and the audio parts of Google Hangouts, it doesn't really. Instead, if you activate one of those calls, it will just open up a Chrome window and use it inside of Chrome. So it allows you to start chats inside of this application, but you'd actually have to perform those chats in Chrome, for example. I think this is interesting that this exists. It's probably useful for a lot of people. I know some people who do like to use Hangouts. If you are one of those people, then this might be something you might like to check out. And you can find a link to it in the show notes for the desktop client of Google Hangouts, Yak Yak. So we have a live update for the Yak Yak topic. Thanks to the live chat for the stream, I was notified that Google Hangouts has announced that Google Hangouts will be discontinued. Well, not really, but kind of. The consumer section of Google Hangouts will be discontinued in 2020. So the Yak Yak application is still relevant for the time being, and it might be more useful in the future for like the business users. Maybe I don't sure not sure how they would adjust for that, but they have. But Google has announced that Google Hangouts for the consumer side will be discontinued in 2020. So I just thought that would be something that was really odd that I just chose to talk about this topic or this application, and all of a sudden Google decides to, and I did not plan that. So yeah, anyway. So thanks to the live chat for letting me know about the update to the Google Hangouts, and so I could put it in the show. And if you would like to join the live chat in a future episode, you can join us on every Saturday where we typically stream somewhere around, I can't really give you a time frame. It's every Saturday, but just, join the Telegram group or follow on Twitter or Mastodon to get updates of when it's about to go live. Because it does fluctuate a little bit. Every time. I'm going to work on that. But anyway, if you are interested, you can find a link to the Fortune article about the Google Hangouts announcement, as well as Yak Yak in the show notes below. Up next in the show is Clear Linux, which is a distribution from Intel. Intel's Open Source Technology Center creates Clear Linux, and this particular release of the latest release have a lot of new things. They created a live environment ISO. They've also made a new installer to make it easier to use desktop, the desktop version of Clear Linux. So if you haven't heard, Clear Linux is the Intel distribution, and Clear Linux is, what's interesting about it really is that a lot of the time it's at the, like, the peak of benchmarks. Like, it's not always the winner, but the benchmarks are usually, you know, it's in the top 20% most of the time. And in most and in many cases, it also does win outright a lot too. So it's really interesting, is that a lot of, like, it might be something worth checking out, but it's very kind of complicated in how they structure it and things like that. But the latest version is making that easier. They still have a lot of work to do in that sense, but for the most part, they are making it much better. They used to use XFCE. They've now switched to having versions with GNOME and KDE Plasma. So you can have either one of those if you like. And they've also created a new installer for their desktop edition of Clear Linux. Now, the installer is, well, it's basically like an incurses terminal installer. So while it's not like a terminal, like command running stuff, but it is like a terminal installer. So it has like a text-based graphics kind of thing. It's more like if you just search up incurses installer, it'll look like that. Or actually, I'll have a link in the show notes to an article about the Clear Linux project from Pharonix, so you can check that out as far as like how the install works. But essentially, it is a text-based installer that you go through these different configurations and stuff. The problem with it is that it used to be a lot more limited in how it worked. So once you got it installed, you still had a lot of work to do. So it was basically for experienced people at that point. But now they've done a lot of work to the installer to make it easier to use than the previous versions. It's not really meant for the average user in general, but it is a lot easier to deal with than the previous versions. So if you would you like to give it a try and just to see how it works, you can find a link to Clear Linux in the show notes. Up next in the show is Valve's Artifact game has been released, and it had day one Linux support, so that's always nice. Valve's Artifact is a cross-platform Vulkan-powered digital card collecting game. Valve has done a ton of stuff for Linux for many years. So it's really cool when they announced Artifact, they were going to have day one support, which is kind of like the normal thing for Valve now. But yeah, this is not the first one. But the fact they have day one does show how much they are dedicated to it. Plus the whole Steam Play system, you know. Anyway. Mad respect to Valve, so thank you. If you are curious, it is available now. It's around $19 to purchase it if you are interested. And it is kind of like, it's really interesting because it has a weird approach. So it's a digital card collecting game, kind of like Hearthstone. Except for Hearthstone is you have one you have one board that you battle against. Whereas in Artifact, you have three boards, and they call each of them lanes, three different boards at the same time, and the way you win can be affected by multiple different lane approaches. So it's an interesting structure how they do it. If you would like to learn more about this, you can find a link in the show notes to the game, as well as a link to the Destination Linux episode, which is episode 98, because we had a special guest that joined us to talk about gaming, Linux gaming, especially Artifact. We talked about that quite a significant amount. And that guest was Liam from gamingonlinux.com. So I'll have a link to the game Artifact, as well as a link to the episode of Destination Linux 98, where Liam joined us. So if you'd like to check that out, you can in the show notes. Up next in the show, Amazon has launched a custom ARM-based CPU called Graviton. And this is interesting for many reasons. But first of all, I just wanted to point out that there's this... this is a side tangent, admittedly. But the blog post has a audio file. And essentially, they have this new service called Amazon Polly, which will then transcribe... it'll do text-to-speech... and take it the blog post. So like the audio file is just the blog post in audio form. So if you want to listen to it rather than read it, you know, there's an option there for you. So that's kind of an interesting thing. And then also pretty sure it's a service that people can use. So completely side tangent, not relevant whatsoever. Just wanted to point that out. Thought that's kind of interesting. But what about the CPU? So the CPU has five different versions of it. It's all based on ARM. but they have the A1.medium version, the large, the extra large, the 2X large, and the 4X large. And to go to the peak one, the 4X large has 16 virtual CPUs, and this is like basically threads, and it has up to 32 gigs of RAM and up to 10 gigabit per second bandwidth for the network bandwidth. So it sounds like a very beefy setup, and you know, you would assume that the AWS would have like the CPU used by Amazon on their own services would be the best option, but apparently that's not the case. So Phoronix wrote an article about benchmarking the new Graviton CPU, as well as some other offerings they have on AWS. So I'll have a link to both the blog post and the Phoronix article. But the Phoronix article basically says that the Graviton used were performed very, you know, quite poorly, actually, like really subpar, and from his benchmarks. And he says, at this point, at the end of 2018, there isn't much to get excited about for these Graviton processors on EC2. Because basically, it won in like two of the like 20 tests he did. So for the majority of the time, it was either at the bottom or in the middle of, well, like, so there's really like most of the other options were better. So it was really interesting that that was the outcome, because I would assume that the Amazon CPU would be the best option for the Amazon services, but apparently at the moment it's not. But if you'd like to learn more about this, I'll have a link to the blog post from Amazon as well as the benchmark tests from Phoronix in the show notes below. Up next in the show is a security issue that the Node.js or the NPM people have dealt with for the event stream hack. Now, the event stream is a package that relates to another package. And effectively, what happened was a module for an NPM was being maintained by someone for many years, but that person didn't actually use that software anymore. So they were maintaining it just out of necessity of like, because they started it more of an obligational thing. They felt like they were obligated to do it. So what happened was this particular person was contacted by someone else who said that they offered to maintain the module so that he didn't have to, because they thought that because they would use it. Well, it turns out that person had malicious intent, and when they took over maintenance, they then started injecting other stuff. So they injected another package that runs an encrypted payload that the NPM people said they don't even currently know what all the payload does because it's encrypted. So they said that if you happen to find the package in your environment, you should absolutely respond as if the system has been compromised and remove it and, you know, clean it out as much as possible, because there's a likelihood that it has been compromised in the same kind of thing. So it's interesting, because the original maintainer said, I don't get anything from maintaining this module, and I don't even use it anymore and haven't for years, and that's why he gave it to someone else. He didn't know that this person had malicious intent, so they basically took advantage of a situation where the guy he didn't really want to have to maintain it anymore because he didn't use it, and he didn't really have an interest in it, and he didn't make any money from it, even though thousands and thousands of other modules depended on it. He didn't really have a benefit to do it. So it's kind of like a situation where the person who's maintaining the piece that's being used elsewhere doesn't have incentive to keep that piece, which then creates a potential issue for in the future. So, example, that it could be something like this, where someone takes over and does malicious actions on it, or they could just stop maintaining entirely, and therefore the people who are depending on it would no longer be able to use it, right? You know. Well, reliably, I suppose. They could still keep using it if they wanted to, but they wouldn't have like anyone guarantee that fixes would be done and stuff like that. It's actually kind of interesting, because this kind of goes along with the idea of the Unix philosophy, which is the, you know, do one thing and do it well, and then everything else would integrate with each other and make things work together. That does sound good, and in many ways it is a good thing. But at certain levels, it gets kind of complicated. So at like this point, this person was making a module that a lot of people depended on, but he didn't really want to make that module anymore, and he only did it out of obligation. So he self-imposed obligation, really. So he had really no incentive to it. So the fact that as soon as someone wanted to take it over, he was, you know, willing to do it because he didn't want to do it anymore. So it creates this, like, it could be a break point in many different ways if you have all these things that are interconnected, because the more gears you have in the machine, the more ways it could break. So anyway, it's just an interesting situation because this is kind of like, it's not like a social engineering thing. It's more of like a situation that it's not a new attack vector or anything. It's more of a thing that could exist and has been known for a very long time that could exist, that could happen. And I don't think there's not really a solution to it other than trying to give incentive to people to maintain these modules. Like if you were example, if you were creating this module that depended on another module and then you wanted to like make sure that module kept working, you could do like donations to that project or something like that. You know, I don't know, something like that. Just, we should just brainstorm about what the possible solutions are in the comments. So if you want to find out more about this issue, you can find a link. By the way, it has been fixed in the sense that they have flagged it and it's been removed. And I'm pretty sure the guy who gave control has got it back. So yeah, we'll have a link in the show notes if you'd like to learn more. So we found another security issue with Marriott. They announced that there was a data breach for their Starwood hotels, and they have confirmed that the hotel guest database has been stolen in a data breach, and it involves about 500 million customers or guests, however you want to call it. They said they detected this in early September, but it may go back as far as like being used to 2014. So it's possible that, you know, for that long period of time, they haven't really said if it's continuously been breached or just that one time. I don't know. But they did say that it was detected in September. The company said that it obtained an encrypted database on November 19th and determined that the contents were from the Starwood guest reservation database. The information that they collected in this is very bad. Very bad. They think that there's not there's not credit card information involved, but they also think that if it is involved, there is some, well, not all the time, but they said sometimes they had examples of credit card data encrypted that was involved, but they don't know if they actually were able to breach and take the decryption software too. So we don't know what that's happening, but there's stuff that's even worse than that anyway. So let's just talk about it a little bit. So guest name, naturally, postal address of where they live, their phone number, the date of birth, their gender, their email address, their rewards information from their points or something, arrival and departure information for their flights, arrival and departure information from being at the hotel, sorry, reservation date, and even the communication preferences, whether you like text or phone or email or whatever. But to make it even worse, they also got passport numbers they say that not all 500 million, but all of those things that I listed has affected around 327 million records. So, yeah. And the passport number is one of the worst things to have because there's such a huge chain, because Marriott is the biggest hotel chain in the world, like 1,200 properties or something, it makes it, not very good. Because having the passport means that you have like a global identification number for someone, and you know, one of the worst things you could get. Well, the credit card, actually, the credit card is probably one of the easiest things to not worry about. Like if someone were to take your credit card in a breach, you could just call your credit card company, cancel the card, get a new card, and you're fine. You know, it's not technically it's not directly connected to you. It's connected to their company. So the money in a credit card is not actual money, you know? So, like, for example, a debit card, if someone were to take your debit card and use it, well, they just took your money because it's in your bank. It's coming directly from your bank, so they did take your money. It would be very difficult to get the money back. But the credit card is different because you can take a credit card and you have, like, 30 days to pay it off. So you could just contact the company, said, hey, it was stolen. I didn't buy any of that stuff. Cancel the card, blah. And they'll be like, okay, cool. We'll cancel it. It's, you know, move on, and they'll send you a new card. That's it. So in a sense, the credit card is one of the easiest things to get rid of or to replace and, you know, bypass the problem. But the passport and your name and your address, not good. Anyway, what is another interesting piece of this is that because they found out and they detected in September, they decrypted it and obtained the information in November 19th, and we only recently found out about this a couple days ago, means that they might, I don't know when they technically disclosed it, but they might have missed the GDPR requirement of 72-hour notice, because there's a clause in the new EU GDPR that says once you detect and confirm a issue, like a data breach, you have to disclose it within 72 hours of finding out. It sounds like they didn't do that. So there's a potential for a pretty big fine towards Marriott from the EU. So I'm curious to see how that goes, because it's not good that this breach happened anyway, but it is going to be interesting to see what happens with the GDPR issue related to it. So if you'd like to learn more about this particular situation, I'll have a link to a blog post about it in the show notes below. Up next in the show, the Linux Foundation has partnered with the RISC-V Foundation, and they announced that they have a joint collaboration effort today to promote the open source development and adoption around the royalty-free CPU instruction set architecture that is RISC-V. Or RISC-V. I'm not sure if it's RISC-V or RISC-V. I think it's RISC-V, but I could be wrong. I'm going to continue calling it that, though. So if I'm wrong, let me know. Both parties are hoping this will grow the RISC-V ecosystem and lead to new applications and architectures for computing. The Linux Foundation says they will be providing an influx of resources for the RISC-V ecosystem, such as training programs, infrastructure tools, as well as community outreach, marketing, and legal expertise. So that's pretty cool, because they're, you know, promoting the open source CPU architecture, or the instruction set architecture, or the ISA. I'm not sure if that's an acronym for that or not. But it's pretty cool that they're doing this, because the RISC-V is pretty cool, and any kind of like the open source instruction set is very important, and it's a very, very important thing if it had more adoption, it would be really good, because, you know, open source any kind of thing is typically good. I can't say always good, but it's typically good. So I really like to hear about the Linux Foundation, you know, helping out, you know, providing tools and facilities to facilitate the growing of the community and the potential of the RISC Foundation itself, or the RISC-V Foundation itself. So anyway, if you'd like to learn more about this and find a link in the show notes to the blog post from the Linux Foundation, as well as the RISC-V Foundation. So I'll have that in the show notes. Up next in the show is Facebook's Bolt, or the Binary Optimization and Layout Tool, which is designed to speed up Linux binaries. It's a Linux command line utility used for optimizing performance of binaries. That's how they describe it. And it's a Facebook incubator project for speeding up these binaries of the x86-64 ELF binaries, as well as another architecture. I don't remember exactly which one, but similar, x86, similar thing. Bolt, this is how they describe it on the GitHub page. Says Bolt is a post-link optimizer developed to speed up large applications. It achieves the improvements by optimizing applications code layout based on the execution profile gathered by the sampling profiler, such as the Linux perf tool. So essentially, it just kind of like takes the code and optimizes the code to see if it will perform better. And it supports with LLVM, as well as, I think they're pretty sure they're working on support for GCC. And it's, yeah, okay, it does work on GCC and CLang as well, too. So, they claim to it does. What's interesting about it is that I'll have a post to the GitHub page in the show notes, but also the link to a Pharonix article about it, because he said that he's interested to see what happens. He's going to like think about benchmarking. He said, I probably will benchmark it, but he hasn't done so yet. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes. So hopefully having a link to that, if he does an update to that post and saying like, does the benchmark, it'll be there. So that'd be good. Anyway, if you're interested in checking out more about the possibility of speeding up Linux binaries if you're in kind of like a development, you're a developer or a distro maintainer or something like that. I have a link to the Facebook's Bolt. I mean, it's Facebook, so, I mean, it's open source, so I guess kind of, but yeah, it's Facebook, so. Anyway, I have a link in the show notes. Thanks for watching this episode of This Week in Linux. If you like what I do here on the show, please like that smash button and be sure to subscribe. If you'd like to support the channel, we have multiple ways to contribute via PayPal, Patreon, and many others. You can learn more by going to tuxdigital.com/contribute. Or you can order the Linux is Everywhere t-shirt by going to tuxdigital.com/linuxiseverywhere. Or if you're in Europe, you can go to tuxdigital.com/linuxiseverywhereeu for shipping inside of Europe. We also have ways to contribute without any cost to you by using our affiliate links. You can find links for places like Amazon, private internet access, and many more by going to tuxdigital.com/affiliates. If you'd like to submit some news for the show, you could do that at the subreddit by going to thisweekinlinux.reddit.com. If you'd like some more podcasting goodness from me, then check out the latest episode of Destination Linux, as I'm a co-host of that show. And just a reminder, the show is live usually every Saturday, so join us in the live chat room to discuss all the latest Linux news each week. Thanks again for watching. I'm Michael Tennell with Tux Digital. And as always, keep using, learning, and enjoying Linux.